p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Program.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So we welcome, oh, increasingly effective players on the team of creation. May it be so. And what a perfect seaweed segue we have from our previous splendid show, because we are here gathered to dedicate ourselves to the ocean. And everything is in line with that. We don't even need to know astrology. We just pause to consider, which means with the stars, in order to avert disaster, which means against the stars. So our big themes right now, this is our last show in Pisces before the vernal equinox, which is next Tuesday, which will be at 5:08 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Daylight time, so early, what a Republican plot. But we work with everything. And of course it'll be 8:08 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And if you know allies on the East Coast outside Washington D.C., I will be giving my vernal equinox address, cavorting cahoots with creation. We say, Uranus says to us, humans have set in motion forces so disruptive and dangerous to life that a signal goes out from creation that activates our DNA, our navigational wisdom. Astrology is one of the keys to unlock the code that we may all be in cavorting cahoots with creation. Again, may it be so. So here we are. The predominant patterns that we're all aligning with is Saturn. Dedication is opposite Neptune, the ocean, the sea, the powers of imagination. We say to ourselves, you know, what species would be so, you know, dingy as to poison the water supply and disrupt the ocean? We go, only a species that had forgotten the powers of imagination and reverie. For as long as human history exists, we know that our powers of imagination and poetry have been tied to our kinship with the ocean and with the sea. We say, if the sea dies, so does our imagination, and only our imaginative empathy also can, you know, quicken us so that we may rise to the fore to be really dedicated to the ocean and its wonderful gifts, including seaweed, absolutely. So there is an eclipse this Sunday. We won't see it here in this country. It is a very precise new moon that will be at 7:43 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time on Sunday, and again 10:43 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. This eclipse, this precise new moon in Pisces, the realm of the ocean, and our empathic kinship with all of creation, and our expanded definition of community to include all of the people, the seaweed people, the whale people, the seal people. And that eclipse will be squaring Pluto, the principle of death and rebirth and intensity, which poses to all of us, what must we die to lest we die from this dominance model as opposed to this collaborative model? Today is the Ides of March. And again, we are leading to the first day of spring, which was used in 2003 to begin the bombing of Iraq on the first day of Persian New Year, the first day of spring, meant to be dedicated to life. And we go, And so also today, Thursday, March 15th, is the traditional start of the barbaric annual seal slaughter that takes place on the cold ice floes of northern Canada every year. We are grateful to our allies at SeaShepherd.org for informing of the Sea Shepherd volunteer Steve Thompson has organized a grassroots initiative, a monumental effort for the seals to allow people worldwide to voice their outrage over the cold-blooded murder of over 300,000 innocent seals. Well, innocent seals is sort of redundant, isn't it? And our guest, whom I will bring in moments, our great ally, Michael Stalker, says, yes, this is another incomprehensible barbarity. The hides of the seals are being stored somewhere because folks don't wear fur much anymore. The penises were being sold to China to help men with their problems, but Viagra has really put a dent in that market. And the meat, who eats the seal meat? Nobody, at least in the volumes available. This is a subsidized program to keep fishermen out of the bars during this time of year when the regional fish are not abundant. Oh, humans. And so we say also, you know, quoting great ally in the past, 19th century Friedrich Hundertwasser, who says, "You are a guest of nature, behave." And we go, absolutely, oh, Lordy. So we are welcoming back today our great ally of the oceans, marine acoustician Michael Stocker, that we may honor the oceans, align with its beautiful songs, and quit being so noisy, so cruel, and so rude as a species. Michael brings with him whale songs that we may oralize as well as visualize, and examples also of the lethal naval sonar sound that we may be ever more effectively dedicated to life and beauty. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, thank you, Caroline. It's really an honor to be here again. And what a day. Yes. A lot of things lined up.
Yes, I love the seaweed segue.
That was great. The last thing that was said by the guest was ocean protection. So it's really a sweet theme here. And also, you know, in the context of that, none too late, we're commemorating also today the really devastating whale stranding that happened down in the Bahamas in 2000 when 17 beaked whales, 2002 actually, 17 beaked whales washed up as a consequence of active sonar exercises that the Navy was conducting down there, and they suffered some fairly severe problems as a consequence of the noise. They're hemorrhaging around their ears and internal organs, and they apparently ran to the surface so fast that they were unable to evacuate their lungs, and so they had all kinds of internal organ damage as a consequence of you know, the expansion of the air inside their bodies. So these bodies look like milkshakes inside, and the Navy was spending a lot of time kind of denying their responsibility in this, and it was really after a couple of years of fairly dedicated study and also the spiriting away of the evidence so that the Navy couldn't sequester it, that we found that it was fairly refutable. The Navy was responsible for that little problem. So that was...
How did they spirit away the evidence? Where did
Well, they didn't actually. Ken Balcom, who was, it was his lab down in the Bahamas, who was actually studying these beaked whales. And just by happenstance, one of them washed up right in front of his lab. And these are animals that we know very little about because they're very, they come to the surface very rarely. They spend very little time there. And so he had an opportunity to study in depth the physiology of the whale as well as the damage done by these. They were taken, I should say, one of the heads was taken and examined up by Darlene Ketton up at the Woods Hole, and a lot of the damage was found through that. Some of the other necropsies revealed the other stuff. Well, Ken kind of had a feeling that maybe this necropsy study was being sponsored by the Navy, that perhaps he should also hold on to some of the documents, which he did. And that's what I meant by spirited away, because there's a chance that we might not have found out much about it had the Navy been able to kind of bury the evidence in their Byzantine archives.
And there have been many such strandings due to Navy sonar, the dolphins and so on in Hawaii as well, and around.
Well, there's a yeah. record of this. It goes back now, you know, almost 15 years. So it's being kind of brought to light. You know, when I first started getting involved in this back in 1992, the problem was a low-frequency active sonar program called ATOC, as acoustic thermography, and they were talking about broadcasting ocean, this noise across the Pacific Basin, which I, as an acoustician, didn't think was a very good idea. And so I started attending hearings back then, and it was really kind of the camel's nose under the tent, because this new active sonar technology was just beginning developed at that time. And as it is has developed, we've seen increased incidence of catastrophic strandings of marine mammals as a consequence of these Navy exercises, to the point now where, you know, last year you could almost set your watch to it. there was a couple of strandings down in the Florida Keys and also in the Carolinas, and they're all really definitely concurrent with Navy exercises, so the evidence is fairly clear.
So, and also we've oh sorry
no yes, go yes. ahead go ahead.
Well, we've done shows on this before, and we can remind people what this is and what they can do. This low frequency sonar, because again, like so much that's lethal in our world, it doesn't sound so bad. Low frequency sonar. It's like, I want to change, you know, global warming to catastrophic climate change, you know, which is, because warming sounds too kind of comfortable.
Yeah.
And you had mentioned before, you know, we remember the word obscene means literally off stage, you know, comes from Greek tragedy. And what you'd reminded us of is that we see there's the visible strandings, but you have also so well guided us and will again into the ocean as an acoustic environment. There's so much repercussion, I mean literally, to this of animals that just sink to the bottom and die that we don't see.
Or fisheries that don't recover, or any number of different biological problems that... You know, it's interesting, obscene is non-seen, but absurd is also unheard.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
So, a good one to carry around. Yeah, and, you know, one of the things that people were kind of not really alarmed about when the initial discussions about using the ocean as a communications net, much like they called it a sea net. They could just kind of stick noise in the ocean, and anywhere you wanted to listen in, you just stick a hydrophone down there, time correlate it to your source, and all of a sudden you could talk to anybody in the world. Sounded like a great idea, except, you know, for the last quite a bit of time, animals have been adapting to the acoustic environment of the ocean already. They use that sound channel. So by us getting in there and interfering with that, we're going to have some significant biological consequences. And there's beautiful sounds that are made by animals. For you know, we know of the humpback whales. This Song of the Humpback Whale, which is recorded by Roger Payne back in 1971, really kind of was the first poetry that came out of the sea in this culture, because the Greeks, of course, knew about this thousands of years ago. But at that point in time, we felt, wow, these marine mammals sing songs to each other, and they're complex, and they're poetic, and they're beautiful and enchanting. But we have other animals in the ocean which also make sounds, not just the humpback whales, and not just the whales in general. We have fish that rely on sounds, the sounds of their surroundings as well as the sounds that they make, and invertebrates, other different creatures which really adapt to their surroundings with sound. And the sound is beautiful. I mean, it's really...
Balance. And you brought some with you.
I brought a number of different sounds. Just to kind of, one of the issues with the fish is the fish don't really respond to pitches like mammals do. Mammals are really the only animals that have cochlea, which really are the adaptation to pitch discrimination. But other animals have other ways of adapting or hearing acoustical energy. For example, the fish have these lateral lines on the sides of their bodies, which help them, you know, establish their relationship with their surroundings through kind of the motion of the water as it's excited by sound, or the motions of their own body as they are moved by the sound that's in the ocean. So they have these sounds. The fish sounds are not very endearing. There's like grunts and snorts and things like that. Let me see if I've got here. I've got a few here. Croaker. Here's a. I wouldn't necessarily go too far to listen to a concert of croakers, but croakers...
Well, but to a croaker mom...
Of course.
It's completely endearing.
I have the midshipmen that basically are chorusing together, and you hear this... And it's kind of neat. The chorusing is actually an interesting behavior. There's some of these croaker-type fish, drum, that were recorded off the coast of San Diego, between San Diego and Tijuana, 25-kilometer... stretch of ocean, that these fish were chorusing like crickets, but they were doing it like a stadium wave, kind of like can-can girls. So, you know, back and forth. So what tells me is that the croakers in San Diego have something to do with the croakers in Tijuana. They're locked into each other's sound somehow. They're saying something to each other. They're conferring information across that distance. And it's just croaking. It's like crickets cricking in a sense, but it was an amazing discovery that animals were not just necessarily making these sounds to, you know, define immediate territory and defend their right to mate or to eat or whatever it is, that they actually have a community context that is so large that it goes across kilometers.
Take us back to, again, the disruption of these loud sounds, certainly of boats and of offshore drilling, but also the low-frequency sonar. What does the Navy think it's doing? Why does the Navy think it needs this? Just remind us.
Well, I mean, a lot of what we're doing now strategically in the ocean is really supporting our submarine fleet. And back 100 years ago, the vessel of dominance, and this comes from a Navy strategic quote, gentleman who was giving a lecture a few years ago. The vessel of dominance was the destroyer, and the destroyer would pull into a port and basically pummel the port, and that was the supply lines to the outside world that the port had. And by way of that, they would really weaken a nation's ability to be able to support themselves through conflict. In World War II, that changed because we had the development of the airplane, and so the vessel of dominance became the aircraft carrier, and you could move airplanes around from place to place and use those airplanes to also disrupt infrastructure, to bomb railways and ports and what have you. Well, the vessel of dominance now is the submarine. And what we can do to the submarine is we can sneak in under the detection envelope and sneak into ports and go in and destroy them or do nasty things and disappear. And because they're surreptitious, they're submarines, you don't really know who did it. It could be anybody. And the only challenge here is that we need to figure out how to communicate to the submarine. So one of the ways of using sound in the ocean is to use this low-frequency communication program. So that's one of the programs that they're operating. Right now, the low-frequency active sonar, thank you to NRDC, is just limited to 1 million square miles somewhere in the South Pacific. But the Navy, again, is expanding their desire, and they want to insonify 80% of the world's oceans with a sound that sounds like this.
Okay.
Except, you know, for long stretches of the time and throughout the day and what have you. Yeah, it's sweet. The dulcet strings of low-frequency active sonar.
Yes, no, it does. It makes you weep. And you also said that the Navy had asked for an exemption from the Marine Mammal Protection Act and gotten it.
Well, that's another reason why I felt it was important to really bring this attention up right now. The California Coastal Commission, back in December, was given a, I guess, kind of a set of documents by the Navy called a consistency determination that basically looked at an exercise that the Navy is going to be doing off of the Southern California coast involving sonar, among other things. And the document basically it stated that the Navy was not going to be violating California environmental law. Well, I went down there with CFLOA, which I'm the science advisor for this organization, along with some other folks from NRDC, and Kara Horwitz presented with them, and we had some other folks. Mark Palmer was with us from Earth Island. And we basically testified on behalf of the oceans that the environmental destruction that was going to be brought about by the sonar was going to violate California environmental law. Sarah Wan, who was on the California Coast Commission, was really focused and assiduous in terms of sorting through what the Navy's proposal was, and also with the help of NRDC came up with a set of guidelines or mitigation guidelines that prohibited the Navy from using sonar to the extent that it would expose animals to a certain level. The number happened to have been 153 decibels, but a certain level. And the Navy kind of had to take that back and reconsider it. We had a second hearing down in Los Angeles in January, and the Navy took that back and considered it. Again, good testimony on behalf of a lot of the environmental organizations and 3,000 letters that were sent to the California Coastal Commission on behalf of the oceans. And the Navy came back a little while later and said that they weren't going to pay attention to the California Coastal Commission. So that's still in play right now in terms of from a legal standpoint. But also, almost immediately after that, the Navy, realizing that they've been backed into a corner on this particular issue, have decided that they don't want to really play the games by the rules. And they have asked the Department of Defense for an exemption from the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which they have received. Again, this isn't the end of the story, but it does show that, you know, the Navy is not necessarily in their bright, shining glory right now of protecting the seas, as they've stated they've been good stewards of the ocean. Well, this is kind of contradicts that. And I guess the other thing that go ahead, I'm sorry.
Maintain your flow.
The other element of this, though, is that there are alternatives. I mean, there are other ways of communicating underwater. The whales have been doing it for a long time. You know, if we maybe looked at using biological sounds, as opposed to these ones that animals are not adapted to, we might be able to get the same thing accomplished and also do it in a way that works within the biological niches that exist in the ocean right now. I'm going to play a sound. This is beluga whales, and this is in the mid-frequency communication socialization sounds of belugas. And I kind of like it. Here it comes. Now, if you can, it's kind of sweet. They're called the they're called the canaries of the sea, for good reason.
Right. Well, because when you played the low frequency sonar, I mean, just even at that level, it did. It made me want to thrash and go crazy. Like, just even just that little fragment that you did. I mean, sound makes us go crazy. You know, the hum of the next door, you know, central air system. You know, but the beluga whales is sort of like, ooh.
Yeah.
I know you just got back from swimming with whales or being very close to them. And when I've swum with wild dolphins and, you know, in a completely polite way, you can feel them checking you out, and the sound is so wonderful. Like the beluga whale canaries.
They play your bones like a xylophone, you know, you just feel it's up and down your spine. It's an incredible.
Yeah. It feels like a complete medical checkup. Yeah, that it's actually very good for us. You know, euphonic, as opposed to damaging.
Right.
So yeah, so there's the beluga whales in their canary-like sound. So have you pitched to the Navy that they could try and learn?
This is kind of the ongoing discussion. I mean, the Navy is fairly large, and they don't just pay attention immediately. You have to continue to kind of ring the bell. But there is some motion. There is a recent study where they're talking about using dolphin-like sounds to convey information. One of the challenges is that, you know, military contracts are sewed up, they're let out, and they have decades sometimes where they're just obligated to buy this equipment. It's expensive, and everybody's kind of resigned to it being good. You know, to play, for example, the Navy alternative to the beluga sound, I've got this little sweet sound here that if you're wearing earbuds, maybe turn it down a little bit.
Okay.
There we go. Here, is it quiet? No, that's there you go. This is... That's called C-53 sonar, and
it's better, but it still makes me want to thrash and kill things. Humans.
Kind of like a 20-foot fingernail on a 100-foot blackboard, a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, that particular sound. You heard in the introduction of that. I guess I played the longer version of that. But the people who were talking in the beginning were in whale observation boats, and the whales were behaving very bizarrely. There were orcas up there in the Hara Straits.
When they were hearing that. Yeah.
Yeah, they were basically trying to get away from it. They were, you know, in close to land. They were stampeding was the word that they used. So it was an unfortunate. After that, there was about 16 harbor porpoises that were found washed up. There's no direct evidence tying them to the acoustic trauma there, but the orcas themselves, which were only exposed to 150 decibels or so, 150 to 160 decibels, were traumatized. It was really clear their behavior was one of escape. So if they heard the beluga sound as opposed to the C-53 sound, they may have not made a run for it. So that's the challenge. You know, we have these noises we're bringing to the ocean, which the animals are not biologically adapted to. And so what we're trying to do is really kind of open people's hearts, eyes, and minds up to this and give them an opportunity to really think about it some more. I've been working with this group called Seaflow for the last 7 years as a science advisor, and we're really opening up the discussion. The challenge that I had prior to that time is that the scientific inquiry is full of a lot of big numbers and cryptic language and what have you, and to try to intersect that with the the council passion of a group of dedicated environmentalists who may not understand the complexities of acoustics, but do understand, you know, the beauty of the web of life. And so we kind of joined our forces together, and we've been doing a lot of advocacy work. I've been talking a lot to the Navy folks, the acoustics people who are doing the studies, et cetera, and we've been also doing a lot of public outreach and information in various different ways. So,
because of course, when you're bringing up alternatives, the crucial concept of biomimicry, as exemplified by many people, including the work of Janine Benyus, who has a great book, Biomimicry. So yes, she says, you know, how do we not steal or take from nature, but borrow her recipes and study her ingenuity and align with that? And we go, yes, in every fabric of our being and our culture, we want to go that way. I liked our seaweed segue from the previous show, and the great guests, thereon too, who were talking about, you know, if you eat seaweed, then you will be full of actual iodine and you will not absorb radioactive iodine. And for years I've used that as the crucial metaphor of the toxic mimic. You know, if we are full of iodine, we won't absorb toxic iodine, radioactive iodine. If we are full of imagination, we won't absorb the toxic mimic of celebrity culture. If we're full of, you know, so that was that's a good lead-in. And you're talking to the Navy about biomimicry, and I think the Navy is really on our table here, because you said the Navy is the single biggest user of fossil fuels, and of course then they're employed in submarines and whatever, to fight for remaining fossil fuels. But you'd said that it takes 2 million gallons of fossil fuel to get a battleship to move 15 miles.
Yeah, an aircraft carrier, but that's just one vessel, and they are always accompanied by, you know, all this whole fleet. Yeah, so where's the asymptote here? If we had less aircraft carriers, would we need less fossil fuel, hence less aircraft carriers? At some point in time, we could kind of cool the flames of this anxiety.
And less war, and that's right, and less destruction of the ocean. And yeah, it is a giant nut, but if you begin to pull one thing, and again, appeal to common sense and logic. I mean, I know, but I think it's like this, what you mentioned about dealing with the Navy bureaucracy. I mean, to turn one of those boats around takes a long time because it's moving, consuming 2 million gallons for every 15 miles. And then if you want to turn around, it takes a long time to turn around. And that's really what you're talking about, the naval contracts with low-frequency sonar and the bureaucracy. It takes a long time to turn it around, apparently, given all rationality.
Definitely. And we have another element of this, which is kind of frightening, is that these people are very invested in their momentum.
Yeah, and, but it's 15 million gallons per 15 mile, or 2 million gallons per 15 miles of momentum. Yeah. So there's a lot of, there's a lot of economics invested in this, and so we go, okay, but you know, as you know, against all odds are the odds that the trickster likes, and that's why, well, when I'd said, you know, if we could all visualize something as well as be active in every common sense possibility, and you know, and honor and go, you know, thank you Australia for denouncing illegal Icelandic whaling. That's good. Thank you SeaShepherd.org. Thank you Seaflow.org. Thank you NRDC.org. You know, and aligning with these beings, you know, to bring common sense. And I found from our last shows, Michael Stocker, a great marine acoustician ally, you know, when I'd presented this to school kids, your material, they were like, oh, this is terrible. And they all wrote, like, the governor and the senator and the congressman. I mean, I think children, it's important, too, because they go, oh, how could they? I mean, there are the charismatic animals who are important. The seals, but we're, you know, killing those seals. 300,000 seals starts today, like, for no reason. And the whales and the porpoises. But you have been a great advocate for the less known, less charismatic, we need everything, we need everybody parts of the ocean and the sea, and that it is all one, you know, orally, Well, you said that when guide us into it right now before break and then afterwards, you said that when things, the sound of the environment, when humans are not messing with it but participating in it, is like a well-tuned orchestra.
Yeah, we tend to look at heroic animals. We tend to look at things in heroic terms. But really, the fabric of life is what we need to consider. And a recent article in Nature just last week talked about looking at ecosystems as opposed to looking at individual species, and even indicator species were just a kind of a step to this larger idea of the whole fabric of life. And when the fabric of life is whole, the textile is beautiful and deep, and the colors are full, and it really has a complete picture to it, much in the same way that sound in a good, well-tuned environment is like a well-tuned orchestra. And you just hear all the frequencies covered, the biological niches are where they need to be, the animals that hear high and, you know, hunt and do that strategic stuff are in the high frequency range, those animals that need to locate long distances in low frequency range, and when it's all there, it sounds beautiful. It's a gorgeous...
So
it's an orchestra.
We're gonna take a very short break. You're gonna guide us into your chosen break music, yes?
Yeah, we have some humpback whale sounds, sing songs from Maui. There's a whalesong.net. This came from their hydrophone. You hear some splashing of water. It's dangling in the sea, but you can hear this. This is recording off of their hydrophone.
Wonderful. That's wonderful. That was the song of humpback whales, yes?
Yeah.
Our guest today is Michael Stocker, a marine acoustician. We are dedicated to the ocean and to being better citizens of creation. We, as a extremely rude species, making all kinds of loud, cruel sounds, and Navy sonar and boat sounds. And you'd also mentioned before, I know that you're involved with Vortex Technology, yes, in which we could actually make motors that had no sound.
Yeah, it's actually interesting that the seaweed theme comes up. I met a man, Jaden Harmon, a few years ago, and he has been working on flow forms in nature, and I became pretty deeply involved in the development of some of his ideas. He initially saw seaweed on the beach and thought about how seaweed could really weather the tempest of really severe storms without getting pulled apart, and he started looking at how that actually occurred. And over the years, he developed this way of looking at flow forms and help inducing those forms through things like propellers and fans and what have you. He initially pulled me in to try to evaluate the noise of a propeller he designed, or excuse me, a fan, like a bathroom fan he designed. And against a standard bathroom fan, which was fairly noisy, 65 dBA at 1 meter, his bathroom fan was, the motor was louder than the fan was. So it had some other properties too, but the quietness was the initial thing I was brought in on. They're now doing quite well, developing a lot of different applications for this technology. In fact, Janine Benyus is on their advisory board. The organization is called PAX Scientific. They do really great work, and some of the work that is in the future for that organization is propellers for boats. And I'm going to play a little cargo ship here to see one of the things that we could quiet down, if you have a moment.
Yes.
This sounds pretty innocent, but the sounds of cargo ships, there's over 85,000 boats plying the seas right now. Actually, 45,000 at any given time, approximately, according to Lloyd's of London. And they're creating such a din in the ocean that the noise floor in the ocean has increased by a factor of 10 in the past 50 years. So it's 10 times louder than it was in 1964, or actually 40 years. It's 10 times louder than it was as a result of just cargo ships. And so we'd like to try to find ways of quieting those down. And some of these using nature's flow forms is, would provide us with some opportunities here. There's hope.
So, yeah. There is hope, and there is ingenuity, and we are wealthy, and we are drawing upon those qualities that make us proud to be human rather than ashamed. You know, when we were speaking backstage yesterday, I said that, you know, when I was in one of the oldest souks in the world, the great marketplace of Aleppo in beautiful Syria, we found ourselves spiraling into the center, and a man said, "Oh, welcome to my shop." And here is the oldest mental health healing center in the Middle East, maybe in the world, several thousand years old. And they said they primarily healed people with the sound of water. I was like, oh, yes. The sound of water. Because even when you play the, you know, from whalesong.net, the humpback whales and with the microphone in the water, the water sounds good with also the humpback whales who had, they had quite a lot of repertoire. They had the moaning, the whistling, the trilling. Can you do those?
I usually avoid trying to mimic those beautiful animals.
Right, because they only laugh at us when
Can you sing like Pavarotti? Well, I wouldn't want
to. Yeah, that's right. Although it is, you know, unlike trying to speak French, trying to speak Spanish, in which Hispanic people are so encouraging and kind, you know, that they want us to do. I think of the animals as well. Sometimes when I talk to crows, they are like, oh, humans are so primitive, but I sort of think they don't mind the attempt.
I think crows probably won't.
Yeah. Well, they do laugh at us, you know, and also we don't really know what we're saying. Of course, you know, that's an important thing. What is that human saying? They just have no idea.
You know, it's interesting about because crow. The, oh, so go ahead.
Yeah.
Crows have a repertoire of maybe 200 sounds they make, and the crows in New York have the same sounds that the crows in France have, of the same species, but they speak a different language. They use them differently. So they couldn't understand each other.
Right, and they pass on knowledge.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Yeah? Yeah, because we had a terrible thing on the East Coast, which is the West Nile virus wiped out all of our crows and owls and blue jays for a long time. And so now after several, and it was terrible, I mean, it disrupted everything because the hawks came in and then the hawks ate all the squirrels. And so we were low on squirrels as well. You know, it is all one thing. So now the crows are coming back, but they have no elders and they're kind of clueless, like, well, we don't quite know what we're doing here. And so a whole oral tradition, because apparently much is taught, got wiped out. And maybe you could speak to this part also of whale lore and what we know about the whale songs. You've spoken before about how the noise in the ocean is changing the songs, disrupting them, but also changing them. And what about also the transmission?
Well, we know that the humpback whales have songs that are seasonal. They actually have a repertoire they develop. And there's a lot of conjecture as to how those songs actually become popular. But it's like they have their top 40, and the various whales in the very area will sing that song. They'll try to mimic it. And it'll change over the years. Something happened interesting a couple of years ago. Eastern and Western Australia have their two different individual distinct groups of humpback whales, and they have their distinct songs which help identify them. But there was, in fact, a cross-pollination between the East and the West Coast whale groups. So they actually had song elements that they'd shared with each other somehow. It's a mystery as to why or how it happened, But we do know that whales do communicate over long distances. Now, the humpback whale songs that we hear, we're familiar with, are produced by the males, and they seem to be associated with breeding, mating, mate attraction, or what have you. But there are a lot of sounds that the baleen whales make, which are really distinctly low-frequency, long-distance communication sounds that you can hear for thousands of miles in the ocean. And these animals use these sounds to navigate. Chris Clark had a really amazing paper that was put out about 4 years ago where he followed blue whale navigation, and they didn't just go from up in the Bering Sea down to Hawaii in a beeline. They followed geographical features, and the conjecture in the paper was that they either bounced their sounds off of the geographical features, or alternately they were able to hear the characteristics of those in the ocean so as to be able to not allow them to navigate. So there's a beauty in that part of the web there of life. But the challenge here is now as the ocean shipping noises and our anthropogenic noise in the ocean gets louder and louder, will start masking their ability to be able to hear those long distances. And at some point in time, they may not be able to find that seamount they need or that trench they need to be able to get where they need to go. And that's...
Yes, it is so hard to hear the stories of the destruction of community of animals that the rudeness of humans is imposing. Collapse, the cataclysmic collapse of elephant culture as well, and that it is all tied again, that sense of if we destroy the communities of animals, we of course destroy the communities of humans. It makes us crazy. It is all one fabric, as you say. You know, you'd said also backstage, you know, you said that, you know, it is important in our activism to do this for joy. And you'd said that, you know, long after, you know, that you had departed your flesh, you know, there would still be these ocean issues. But what is your sense of we are dedicated to do as much as we can for our kindred with joy?
Well, that's the important part about it. I mean, one of the challenges that I had when I started getting involved in advocacy was that there's a lot of anger out there. And it's understandable because people are seeing something that's dear and near to them, that they're near their hearts, kind of vaporize or disappear. And the challenge with the anger is it compromises our own quality of life. The beauty of the Seaflow folks, when we started working together on this issue, was that they were talking about celebration. Vivian Verdenroe, one of the founding directors, and Hallie Austin Iglehart were both people who had dealt with anger in their communities and in the way of working with stuff, and realized that it wasn't really the best way of getting something done, because it you know, in as much as you might get benchmarks accomplished, you are not getting the quality of life improved. And we have to think in those terms. We have to do this.
Well, let's think of that whatever we're thinking or feeling or expressing or saying is adding to the sound environment in a sense. You know, and so like, you know, we go, oh, the whales don't like that, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So we want, you know, I think it's part of the literalness, the physics and the metaphysics, is that whatever we love, we want to become more like it, to be better advocates for it. Water, whales, wolves, you know, and again, you know, honoring, I remember also when we talk about, sound, you know, my own fantastic wolf doggy, Captain Moondog Wolfie, when we were first, you know, when he first went to the beach, he could hear the dolphins. He was very enthused, you know, and I could see him walking along the shore, and he was like, I mean, he could hear them before I could see them, and then I could see it, but he was like, oh, and, this connection again between land and sea. I mean, I've seen fantastic dogs who love cavorting with seals, and this, you know, this kinship. But he was as happy about hearing the dolphins as about getting dinner, which is saying quite a lot. he was like, oh boy, you know, dinner or porpoise sounds. Ooh, tough call. So this interesting kinship, and again, you know, how do we animate this even more and further? And so we're composting anger as not the most effective. Although, as I said to you backstage, you know, it is a tough one. I mean, I do like, you know, our great ally David Grimes had sent me this postcard picture from Alaska, and it showed two wolves in a Piper Cub airplane with guns, and it was called Predator Control. And part of me, you know, I want to be like the Dalai Lama, but our meanness to animals, you know, does make me want to go like, yeah, you know, and those people clubbing those seals, what a sociopathic species, how could they do that? There's nothing more designed to elicit tenderness in us than the face of those seals, like those two little eyes together and the little nose, and it's like, to be able to just club that is like, ah! I mean, don't you think you'd already have to have been abused and violated and sociopathically dead? And
I think that's probably the issue. And anger is given to us as a gift. It's not a curse. But we have not been able to use that gift properly. And you know, in our culture, we tend to suppress anger until it explodes. But I learned a few years ago that anger is how I protect my perimeter, and I let people know that it exists there, and then I can avoid conflict. If I let people inside my perimeter without managing my anger, then I go, and I freak, and that's no good. But
so your doorbell is like a low growl.
Exactly.
I'd like a doorbell like that. Yeah. Well, I actually have one. I have animals.
Moondoggy, yeah.
Yeah, Moondoggy and Stella Coyote. So anger is how you protect your perimeter. Okay, this is good. Meaning, you know, just say more. Say this again.
What basically happened to me is I had the situation where somebody was questioning my integrity, and instead of letting him do that and going away frustrated, or letting him do that to the point where I was so freaked out that I yelled back at him, something just told me in my ear to say, hold it a second. This issue is not about my integrity. That was my anger saying, look, you just met my perimeter here. And I was firm. I was stern. Uh-huh. I had my feet grounded, and I didn't let it get me. And at that point in time, the particular incident, this guy basically gave all his gold to me, and I wasn't even asking for gold. I was just saying, hey, back off. And he, I realized, had been probably abused by his father, and anybody who expressed anger to him, he would freak out. And we need to learn how to mediate our anger and use it in a righteous way.
And that's why I love the Dog Whisperer, Cesar Millan, who talks about humans becoming pack leaders, calm and assertive, and then the human will imitate that. And he goes, no, that's excited and aggressive, calm and assertive. And I told you the story, again, backstage, let me put it on our work table here, of our ally David Grimes had a friend who was one of the early trainers of the orca whales at some horrible theme park when these were just starting. And his friend trained an orca whale, and the owner, you know, kind of like chomping on a cigar, came out and said, make him do it again. And he was like, okay. So he made the orca do this trick again, and the owner was like, he didn't do it right, make him do it again. And the trainer was like, oh, okay. So he gave the signal, and the orca looked at him and did this in this begrudging way, and then swam directly at him and pinned him to the side of the pool with enough force to say, you know, one more inch and you would be extinguished as an experiment on this planet, you know, but I'm not. I'm just letting you know, eye to eye, whereupon the person quit and said, this whole thing is a terrible idea. I mean, we just shouldn't be, we shouldn't be doing this at all. And so, yeah, so the orca whale, you know, anger is how he protects his perimeter, going, that's enough of that. And we go, yeah. And Carl Hiaasen novels, of course, the evil industrialists are, you know, always eaten by Babu the killer whale at Disneyland and stuff. And but also many people are mystified by these, you know, they're taking note of the anomalous animal attacks. I mean, there have been examples of dolphins attacking humans. In almost every case, some horrible thing was being done to them, like, oh, God. Then, of course, there was the stingrays that took out the possibly pretty loud, but good-hearted, but loud, Australian guy. But then there was the anomalous thing of a month after that, in which the stingray flung itself into a boat in the Florida Canal Keys and stung this retiree guy. We go, what's going on here? Is that anger is how we protect our perimeters? I mean, animals at a snap point going, that's enough. And also, I mean, we don't know what the couple in the boat did, but it might be the boat. I mean, do you think, I know that the more that I as a human am exposed to horrible sounds, the more hypersensitive I get to it. Do you think that's part of what's going on in our whole large pulsing dream of an environment, that there's a hypersensitivity, so even a little bit is too much right now?
Well, yeah. I mean, the snapping points are probably reached in the city a lot more than they're reached in the country, and as much as we're always being accosted by this background in. I mean, you mentioned the hum of the refrigerator or the air conditioner that is, you know, constantly eating away at the perimeter of your consciousness, and you know, at some point in time, your nerves are frayed. You can't protect yourself, your perimeter against that all the time. It's exhausting. So, you know, there's that time where you will go, oh, I can't handle it anymore. I mean, just what
right,
was
I will
2 weeks ago where one of the orca trainers was pulled down to the bottom of the, was a trainer? That's when I was in Mexico, but I heard about this. And it was pulled
It was an orca trainer who was pulled down going, that's enough. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just, you know.
Not killed, not eaten, just enough, right?
That's enough. Well, you know, Doris Lessing in her great novel Shikasta posited that on this planet here, you know, there are three colonizing forces. There's the Syrians, who are basically like cosmic world bureaucrats. They come, they experiment, they don't care. They're sort of sociopathic. The wise Canopians, who aspire to feel what's needed and respond. But then there's Shamat. And she said Shamat feeds on discord. Now, it's her metaphor, but she said it feeds on the kind of, you know, the hum of the nuclear power plant, the hum of the low-frequency sonar, that it feeds something very negative, and it feeds on that. And I think that's... I think, you know, there are certain sounds that, I mean, you are an acoustician. I mean, what is the your understanding or exploration of the kind of supernatural negativity of certain sounds or certain rhythms that just are antithetical to life? I mean, have you kind of teased this out?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of variations in the theme. Everything from that kind of annoying background hum, which fills all the silences between our words, between those things we need to hear. And you know, it does definitely erode our ability to be able to understand, communicate. Our sense of time ends up getting completely discombobulated. You know, we don't have the inhale and the exhale. We don't have those long distances of silence that are unfilled.
So as we're As we're polluting the ocean and then seeking to numb ourselves from what we're doing in the environment, and then, I notice also as I take walks in the woods, I see people talking on their cell phones in the woods. I see people pushing baby carts and talking on cell phones so that children are growing up with conversation that's never directed to them. You know, I see people in the dog park on cell phones not relating to their dogs. And then there's the iPod thing. You know, it's a complicated thing, but are we, you know, creating such catastrophic horror that we then seek to isolate ourselves from it and become more numb, which then increases the, you know, I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a positive feedback loop in the sense that we don't have any mediation, any mediating factors which bring us back to that silent center, which is really important to have. And,
yes.
The inhale, we're just exhaling continuously. We can't do this forever, you know. And that, you know, that idea that we can actually be alone for a moment so that then we can really enjoy the company of others as opposed to constantly being accosted by our own inner chatter so that we don't know if we actually enjoy being with others or what. There's no sense of lyricism.
Well, I think our kinship with animals and our kinship with the sea, and maybe you can guide us into that. I mean, I know when the world is too much with us, I love entering dog mind. I love sitting with the wolf dog and the coyote dog and other people's dogs on the porch and listening with them as they're just listening so far off. They're just listening on sound. They're surfing it to the very edge, and of course they can hear more than we can. But I love, it's sort of like empty mind and just listen out there. And how crucial that is, because, you know, and then in the ocean, the sound of water is crucial in healing and what we really most need. And, you know, maybe you might want to say a little bit about your recent journey to Baja, where the whales, the baby whales would come up and they would want their gums rubbed and they'd want to be friendly with humans. And we might want to talk about these broken treaties and how we can reestablish them. Can you remind us of the whales that you were just whose gums you were just scratching?
That's another one of these great mysteries. You know, these gray whales were hunted all the way up to 1948. So within the living memory of those organisms, there were humans who were killing them, and still now there are some indigenous subsistence harvesting of gray whales is starting to happen. 30 years ago now, the Whale started doing an outreach campaign, and they started contacting humans, you know, and one thing led to the next, and you know, these mama whales were then, you know, after they had sensed their relationship with the people down there, the fishermen down in these lagoons of Baja California, they started introducing their babies to the people. And to this point now, where the lagoons are really, I mean, the full of mamas and babies, because they breed and they also give birth down there, who engage with tourists. And it is actually saving their economy down there from the exploitation of salt plants and their exploitation of superports and other things that would otherwise bring the area money. These people really love these whales. And you can go down in Pongas and basically engage these fishermen who'll take you out and introduce you to this opportunity to meet the whales. And the mamas will kind of check the boats out, and they'll bring their babies over. And these babies are small, maybe only 10 to 12 feet long and only 1,500 to 2,000 pounds. But they're cute. Like all babies are. They're just cute, you know, and they come up and they're nosy, and they kind of stick their heads up above the, you know, the gunnels of the boats, and you can kind of scratch their gums, and they like to have their tongues rubbed or their baleen. Now, this is an exceptional situation. I know a lot of people, you know, don't endorse necessarily that contact, but it seems like a contact with whales and dolphins, because it disrupts them biologically. But this is something where it really seems like the mama whales are initiating this contact. For what reason? We don't really know. But as I say, the outreach committee, we'd have to go back and talk with them about it and find out what they're...
Well, we need these outreach committees, absolutely. Apparently, the whales off the coast of the Dominican Republic, I think it's blue whales, there are groups that go there and swim in scuba. I've seen photos, I've talked to people who've done this, and the whales are giving birth, and they seem to not just merely tolerate, but like humans at this most precious moment when they're giving birth. They like the humans being around the babies, and we go, oh, these are profound, deep mysteries that we want. When I was, again, a tourist thing, but swimming with stingrays in the Bahamas, and it's a million people with too much suntan lotion, and so anyway, but I did see this research scientist, and there was this stingray that was just all over him in the most wonderful way, and he was tickling her, and she was like, ah, and she made her way through all the other people to find this guy. And I said, how did this happen? Do you feed her? And he said, no, she's too excited to eat when she sees me. He would visit her like once a week. They had this profound friendship, and I realized, like, you know, what we humans can do, we can caress with our hands. You know, I mean, she was getting tickled and she liked it, and another stingray couldn't do that. So I think the purpose of humans is to give pleasure to animals. I think that's really what we, you know, that's the broken treaties we want to reintroduce. But in our waning moments, how might you want to invite us to be effective, to join with you and to join with seaflow.org and seaflow.org and nrdc.org and seashepherd.org? And would you like us to visualize and oralize?
If we can end this with the idea of protecting the oceans, or I should say protecting ourselves from this crazy relationship to the ocean where we're cultivating, that's the best thing we can do. There's a couple of things going on. One is objecting to the Navy and they're stepping outside of the law. And there's some, in fact, if anybody is in Hawaii or knows people in Hawaii, tomorrow in Maui, at the Maui Ocean Center, at the Queen Kahumanu Shopping Center, there's going to be a demonstration on the Navy obstinance. And Seaflow has, we have a monthly council meeting of the community, and it's the first Monday of every month, and we have folks come in and give scientific presentations or political presentations. We also have music and poetry and cookies for Mark Palmer. I also have a presentation I'm giving on the Bay Model on March 28th at 7 p.m., that's Bay Model, Army Corps of Engineers in Sausalito, talking about ocean sounds. But really, you know, thank the Coastal Commission. Write those guys and say thank you for, standing up for the environment. Wag your finger at the Navy. Talk to your Congress people and say that the Navy is really stepping outside the law here, and it's inappropriate as stewards of the ocean. We need to think about protecting the ocean, not about damaging it.
Absolutely. Well, bless your work, bless your heart, bless your ears, bless your fantastic sounds that you brought us, too. I'm Caroline Casey. Our guest was Michael Stocker, and we will be in perpetual cahoots. Thanks always to Erica Bridgman in Berkeley and Margot Kelly in Washington, D.C. For a copy of this show, go to visionaryactivism.com or 1-888-741-GUIDES, and we are in perpetual cahoots. Thank you so much, Michael.
Hey, thank you so much. It's been an honor and a blessing.
The KPFA local station board meeting, originally scheduled to take place at the Freight and Salvage in Berkeley, will now be held at Café de la Paz, 1600 Shattuck in Berkeley, Saturday, March 24th, beginning at 12:30 p.m. Pacifica Council Dan Siegel and Pacifica HR Director Yolanda Thomas will be conducting a presentation on the roles and responsibility of board members, beginning shortly after the start of the meeting at 12:30. The board will also be conducting its regular monthly business at this meeting. A draft agenda is posted at kpfa.org/LSB. That's the regular March meeting of the KPFA local station board on Saturday.